you're hearing that. Back to you, Dick.
There's a band opening, Dick. I was hearing that repeater up at the repeater site.
Oh, and also the Selvin repeater doesn't seem to be a operating error.
Yeah, Eric is working on the Selvin repeater. It's had some grief over the last week. And boy, is there a band opening. This exact same frequency, 146.2585, is used by Torrington, Connecticut. And Mother Nature has supplied some kind of an unusual weather condition tonight by which super ground wave signals are coming through and giving us a lot of grief. I do not have Channel 2, CBS television, tonight because the Hartford station that's on the same frequency as my local CBS station is giving me co-channel interference, and my high-definition television over-the-air broadcast converter says, forget it, RIW, no way in hell. I can't figure out what the hell's going on, is what it's saying to me. So I couldn't watch 60 Minutes tonight, and I was a little bit disappointed by that. So, yes, there's a hell of a band opening. That's what you're being subjected to, Paul. And hopefully this doesn't happen too often, so hang in there. And, yes, it's too bad you don't have the fallback of going to the Eastern repeater, which is being repaired. Okay, so Scotter's got his homework cut out for him, and I know where he's coming from. It's not an easy one. But the first answer doesn't have to be perfect. We've all slowly discovered that. Okay, the other John, K2 Kilo Indio Foxtrot. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz tonight, John. Go right ahead with your question or comment, K2RIW at the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick. I did my shopping, and I did all the things I needed to do, so I just got back. You just called me, so you're right on time. I just wanted to ask you, I sat with a fine gentleman this afternoon, and we were doing HF from his vehicle, and he had a A57D, David, and a Addis antenna. Very simple hookup, and we had fun doing HF. I was very impressed with that demonstration. I wanted to know if there was an all-around antenna, if I didn't want to go crazy with all different kind of antenna schemes. Is there an all-around antenna? Probably not high in the dB range, but just one antenna that I can buy just to have some fun with. I know it probably wouldn't, like I said, get a lot of dB range out, but something that's all around that I could just put up like a vertical. Could you suggest anything? K2KIF.
Before I proceed, John, there's an ambiguity in what you just asked me. Are you asking for an antenna for an automobile, like the demonstration that was made for you with the 857D and the Addington, I think it was, antenna? So is it a mobile antenna you're asking for, or an antenna at the house? That one first, John. Go ahead.
I think you caught it, even though I didn't make it clear. Yeah, an antenna for the house, where I could get the same performance and fun out of without having to buy several antennas, several hookups, several, just going crazy buying all these different things. I mean, if you really want to get into it, you just go to the YouTube and you punch in Big Gun, and the guy has every configuration you could ever imagine. And he has plenty of real estate, several towers that are 200 feet high. I mean, you know, you could really go into an extensive amount of money. If you just wanted one antenna, just to have a little fun with, on HF, what would you suggest? K2KIF.
That's a good question, John. Whether know that you know it or not, you're at a crossroads. You're going to have to make a decision. I want the antenna. One possible road you can go down is, I want the antenna to give me the most amount of performance in the least amount of time, and I don't give a damn what it costs. I got a big pocket full of money. I'm just going to go out and buy something big. Now, that's one possible road. Another possible road you go down is that, gee, I don't want to spend any money, but I want a lot of performance. And then that splits into two particular roads. Am I willing to build the antenna, or must it be something I buy? If you are willing to build, you're going to get a tremendous amount of performance out of a thoroughly unknown antenna. A vertical dipole. I didn't say monopole. I didn't say quarter-wave ground plane. I said dipole. If there's a tree on your property that's tall enough so that you can put a vertical piece of wire, a half wavelength long, approximately. There's ways you can shrink it down somewhat. But a vertical dipole can give you two or three times the performance of anything you can buy that you install on the ground in your backyard for that particular band. I'll admit that the vertical dipole is primarily one band at a time, with a slight exception. You do have a 3-to-1 relationship between 40 meters and 15 meters, and there the antenna will work on both bands somewhat at the same time. But a pure vertical dipole, very little material, tremendous performance, thoroughly unknown in any of the books you can read. That's if you're willing to build. Another thing, if you're willing to build, is an ordinary half-wave horizontal dipole thrown up in the air with a bow and arrow, slingshot, whatever, if you've got supports that can give it some altitude, or a sloping version of that. There are lots and lots of antennas you can buy that are quarter-wave ground plane type.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When you see the picture in the book and you read the specifications and you see all this shiny aluminum with all the fancy coils and whatever and the crazy claims of the manufacturer, you can easily be led to believe that, hey, this is the best thing in the world that's ever been invented. You compare that to an ordinary half-wave dipole in the trees made out of a piece of wire and a piece of coax. You'll be kind of amazed at how much better the dipole in the trees works because it's got some real altitude to it. Yes, you choose the right quarter-wave ground plane on the ground, it can give you 80 through 10 meters inclusive. That's the good news. But in order to have true gain, you don't get it without real estate. Let me explain what I mean by real estate. I'm going to drop. You can study as much as you want. Let me drop long enough. You can be led to believe that these various antennas have all kinds of gain claims. For the most part, they're fibs, almost lies. If your radiating structure is a half wavelength long or less, quarter wavelength long or less, the pattern it has is an extremely broad pattern. It does not have the capability of real gain in the usual sense. Gain over something that works terrible, maybe, but real gain, no. Any antenna that has real directivity, if it has any slight flashlight-like capability of squirting all the energy in one direction, it takes multiple wavelengths in at least one dimension to do that. If you're willing to build a collinear array that's made out of three separate half-wave dipoles, for instance, and you stack them correctly, oh yeah, you can get 7, 8, 9, 10 dB of gain out of that thing. If you build it as a Yagi antenna, again, you're using real estate. You can get some real gain. But any of these antennas on the ground that are approximately a quarter wavelength long, are they really going to give you gain? I think the answer is almost no, no matter what the manufacturer said. Let me pass it over to Mel on this one. I bet you he's got some opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I give a good point. Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, the only experience that I've really seen with antennas like that you would like to put up on a patio deck, something simple, not looking to climb, and want something that seems to work reasonably well. I use the word reasonably, you know, with quotes, well, from what I can see. And that is that GAP, the GAP, the GAP Titan. A friend of mine has one. And basically, that's what he's got it on a patio deck, right up against the rail on a short piece of pipe, just high enough so that that bottom so-called radial system that they have, this wire contraption on the bottom, clears any six-footer that may walk under it. And it's not a complicated thing to put together, number one. Number two, quite well made. And from whatever, you know, tech we've made on it, on several bands that it does cover, covers quite a number of bands, it seems to perform reasonably well, Dick. So from the verticals I've fooled with, that in a situation of that type, that seems to work out one of the better ones, Dick. That's just my what I've experienced. Don't quote me, over.
The Gap Titan covers how many bands, Mel, and roughly how many dollars, and roughly how many feet tall is it? Over to you, Mel.
Okay, they have several versions of it. The Gap does put out a number of versions. The one I am talking about is called the Gap Titan, and it covers 80 through, I think, 6 meters, if I'm not mistaken. And the cost at the time may have gone up somewhat, you know, because material cost, no doubt, has gone up in the last few years. And this thing is up now, I'd say 5 years or more. No, maybe 7 years at least now. And it has stood up quite well. And it's being used, and the person that is using it is very satisfied with it because of this situation. Small footprint, that's what is really very attractive. And it stands about, I'd say, close to 27 feet or so high, Dick, over.
You were starting to say the approximate price. If you got a guess on that one, Mel, go ahead.
I'm thinking about it. I can only recall the time. It may be right the number 359 sticks in my head. $359 when I looked at it. To give you a nice bag of pots and all, a lot of pieces, awful lot of pieces, but it's
the first as your first thing. So if I'm mistaken, I'm incorrect. How you doing, Jenny?
So you don't have to run around looking for a tool to assemble it. They even give you that in the package. Prices, I don't know. I guess it's a little bit thick over.
Very fine, Mr. If I understand correctly, approximately $359 a few years ago, and it does cover 80 through 60, and it's got a rather small footprint. By the way, you're hearing the results of band openings going on today, as well as tonight, as well as some intermodulation distortion that is being experimented on by Eric as we speak. So we're going to have a little bit of trouble temporarily, but hang in there, you guys. Eventually it's going to go away. John, I know we haven't really completely answered your question, but at least we've hopefully given you a little bit more information. K2 Kilo India Foxtrot, K2 RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 QIQ with a comment.
Stand by, John. Maybe we're getting a little more here. Glenn, go right ahead.
Listening and, some of this, and one of the, I guess one of the suggestions of an antenna that if I only had to go with one, in other words, I had to for HF and I didn't have anything else that I could put up, my choice would probably be the sand dipole. It's just an antenna that has never let me down in areas where I didn't have any other choices. And basically, I can add as many bands as I want or as large as my property will allow. I can just keep on tagging on another dipole, feed it with a ladder line and an antenna tuner, and possibly a balun if you can add that on to the system. But with an antenna tuner, a balun, ladder feed line, and a band dipole, boy, you can cover an awful lot of bands, and it's really not all that expensive. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Is that fan as in Frank, Apple, Nancy?
It sure is, John. When you start studying the available, Google searches, whatever, for sand dipole, Fox Alpha November. What it really is a whole bunch of dipoles all connected together at the center. One dipole is long enough to be 80 meters, one's long enough to be 40 meters, one's long enough to be 20 meters. They all have a common center. And the magic of that so-called sand dipole is that it automatically electronic switches. When you're on the 15-meter band, 95% of your energy will go down the 15-meter dipole and avoid all the others. So inexpensive, easy to build, is a little bit more work than an ordinary dipole, but when it comes to true performance due to altitude and the number of bands that you're covering, and the fact you've got individual tuning capability by tuning each one of those sections of that fan, you're going to get a lot of bang for your dollar out of a fan dipole compared to some $600 things you can put in the backyard that require 32 that might require 32 radials to get full performance. One of the things that's never made, let me drop. One of the things that's never made fully given out as information about these ground plane dipole, ground plane quarter wave type antennas in the backyard, vertical quarter wave type things, is that for full performance, you need a tremendous number of ground plane radials. You're trying to make your backyard look like a solid sheet of copper. The manufacturer may have told you to put down four radials. He's afraid to tell you more than that for fear you wouldn't buy it. But if you want full performance, you need a whole lot of those. With a half-wave vertical dipole, you need no ground plane radials at all. With a half-wave dipole horizontally up in the air, no radials at all. With a fan dipole, no radials at all. So there's some hidden costs here as far as the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
There's some hidden costs here when it comes to what's really required to install and use and get proper performance out of any of these antennas. Over to you, John, for any other fills and all of the above, and come back with more questions on the exact same subject if you want to. K2KIS, I hope you can get through all this crazy noise. K2RIW.net.
WHCDL with a comment.
Go ahead, CDL.
You got it, Andy.
Is Eric up at the site right now?
I think he is. Go ahead and talk to him.
KE2EJ, WHCDL, are you listening?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm listening, Andy. You know, I left the site. I think I'm going to go back. But, yeah. What's your comment?
Where is that noise coming from?
I haven't a clue.
That's not Intermod. That is not Intermod. That's not a result of those two other bases. I guess you know that.
Yeah, I do. I'm actually going to stop in the house. I'm going to go back and see what it is. But while I was up there on my AT, I was hearing Torrington come booming in.
Yeah, the band was open tonight because I was on ATV and we got some good pictures tonight. So the band is in good shape. I'm listening to a bunch of repeaters. Besides that, okay. All right, thanks. I just wanted to clarify that. And I have a question for you, Dick.
Okay, is it on the subject that's on the table, or do you want me to add you to the list? There's one guy ahead of you named Gary. Over to you, Andy.
Yeah, I'm always listening in the background, as you know. No, it's a question regarding John, because you really should ask him a couple of basic questions. What is his design criteria? Now, anybody can get on HF, but what does he have in mind? Does he want to put up a tower with a beam? Does he want to put up a vertical? Does he want to put up a dipole? I think to start off with some of the basic questions, and because you don't have to spend a lot of money. In fact, I know two towers that are free for the asking from Silent Keys. They want to just have somebody take them down and take them away and somebody to put it up in their own backyard. So there's a lot of stuff out there that you don't even have to spend a lot of money for if you want to put a tower up. So I would just start off with those questions, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay. Possibly John is not quite sure. He knows he wants to not invest a whole lot of money and a whole lot of real estate at first. You know, something not really obtrusive. But maybe he's even considering a tower. Looks like there's a fantastic offer available to you there, John. K2 Kilo India Foxtrot. K2RIW the TechNet.
Absolutely. I would love to have a tower. Actually, I would love to have several towers. One for each band.
But it's not practical and financially not feasible. So I would like to, I think the suggestions tonight were just very good. They were very, very good, accurate suggestions. The fan dipole sounds wonderful. But yes, if I can get a tower up, yes, I wouldn't hesitate on picking it up and taking it down and transporting it. So, Andy, if you can get to me, I'm at johnsrealestate@yahoo.com. And you can send me an email and I'll get back to you. Over to you, Andy, K2KIF.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah. You send me, give me your phone number at my call letters, W-A-T-C-D-L at Opt Online. Just do it that way, then I'll call you back. It's easier that way. And by the way, as a comparison, I own a Gap Titan, and I have a TA-33 on my tower, and I also have a random wire, I'm not going to call it a dipole, just a random length of solid wire going to an antenna tuner, which I resonate to any frequency I want. So I have a choice of comparing. And each one serves its purpose. I'm not going to say one is better than the other. It depends on the application I'm using it for. I'm not a big DXer. I never was. But I have the choice because I just, you know, had the capability of doing so. The Gap Titan is a nice antenna. I bought it used, and I didn't pay much for it. And it had some minor problems, but all I had to do was call Gap and order the parts that were missing, because there were some parts missing, and put it together. It works fine. The only thing is, it's got to be supported, because it's a long antenna. Mel probably knows that. If it's not supported at the top, if you have a heavy wind, it could bend slightly. Which mine hasn't, but a few have. So it's good to guy it if you can with some dacron rope just to support it from the top. Or at the top. All right, I got to go back to what I was doing. Dick, see you later, and I'll call you this week. K2RW, WHCDL.
WGB, with a request.
Stand by a minute, John. Andy, don't go away yet. I got a quick couple of questions for you on this subject. And part of what I'm recommending to John is to recognize the fact that no antenna you're going to build is going to do everything. And most of the antennas you build are so inexpensive, nothing's stopping you from building 2, 3, 4 of them. Give us a very quick thumbnail sketch, Andy. You've got a Gap Titan. You've got a TA-33. Got a long wire. Each has a little bit of a strength and weakness. If you're doing a DX contact and you try calling the guy on the Gap Titan and you don't quite get through the pileup and you go over to the TA-33, I am guessing getting that guy during a pileup is at least twice as easy. So if you're willing to spend the time aiming it carefully, it gives you a hell of a lot more performance than any of the others. That's what I'm guessing is the truth. Give us one or two sentences on each antenna. Where do you use it and what does it buy you? W2CDL, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, the beam, of course, has its advantage because you can rotate it and because it has more gain than the random wire antenna and the Gap itself. I could get some of the weaker signals stronger. And by the way, I had to modify my TA-33. The front-to-back ratio was poor when I first got it, and there was an article on installing a balance, which improves the front-to-back, which did tremendously in my case. And I also have the walkband addition to it, which is just a rotatable dipole, which is actually part of the TA-33. You see, it's the TA-33... the additional kit walk band dipole for those bands. So I don't really operate that much on HF because of just time limitations, but I have it if I want to play around. As I said, I'm not a big DXer, but if I hear a station vertical with the gap, depending on conditions, I go to the horizontal mode, turn the beam antenna, and I can get the station either stronger or weaker depending on the time of day and the condition of where he's located. Let me just let it drop a second. So I have a choice in that matter. The dipole, the long wire, of course, I should say, it's not a dipole, it's just a long wire, you know, being fixed in one direction, gives me a drawback because it's fixed in one direction. I basically have it facing, for maximum signal, east and west, as the dipole, or I should say long wire, is basically north and south. But of course that varies also, depending on conditions. As long as I can resonate it with my antenna tuner, it's fine. Like you say, you resonate, then you radiate. If it's resonant, I get out fine. But overall, the beam gives me a better performance because of the gain of the beam and the fact that I can point it in the direction that I want to. So, if I hear a station on, I just flip back and forth, get an idea of which one is strongest, and then usually I wind up with the beam to and rotate in his direction to get a good signal. And that's it. Nothing more than that. And I don't really have a lot of real estate, but I have enough to do what I want to do with it. Back to you.
Fantastic, Andy. Bears real hands-on experience of a guy who owns virtually each antenna type. He can flip between them and get their relative advantages and disadvantages. From that, you can get a judgment as to whether or not you need that much performance and you're willing to put forth that kind of effort to establish that kind of hardware. But where that tower, which probably is worth some ridiculous number of thousands of dollars, can be had free of charge on the assumption that your zoning board and your wife and your size of land will allow it, guarantee you, John, you're going to get the most amount of happiness out of the tower. I'm a man who's had 60 feet or more, mostly 100 feet for most of the time, of radio tower in my backyard throughout most of my 30-some-odd years of ham radio experience, and I get a lot of pleasure out of the damn thing. Whether it's just bragging rights among my fellow amateurs or real performance of antennas I put on them. But that's me. It's not for everybody. Over you for any fills you might need, John. And good luck on possibly acquiring this tower. I don't think you should turn it down. The price is right. K2KIF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Yeah, we've also got John ahead of you, but there's two Johns, but KIF first. Go ahead, John.
Well, I just want to thank you for all this great information and helping me make this decision. It's difficult when you know actually what it takes to get optimum performance on every band. It takes a lot of money. But that's, like I said, it's not feasible at this time. So we'll probably go with the gap. We'll probably take a look at that and then work some dipoles. But you definitely provided some great information here. Instead of me just going out trial and error on my own, and that could be costly. So I just want to thank you guys for giving me that input. And thank you, Dick,
and everyone else for being on the Tech Night every Sunday. K2RW, K2KIF, over to you, Dick.
Hey, Mel, it sounds like we've got a satisfied customer there. Time for you and your legal department, in the accounts receivable department to send over a bill. That was a joke. John, KC2WGB of the comments. Go right ahead, John.
I think more of a request. If you can, if we have time, could you please add me to the list for a question after Mel?
A small fee involved, but you're on the list. Glenn, KC2QIQ, wait a couple seconds after the beep and go right ahead with your comment, Glenn.
Yeah, it's just one thing I wanted to add was that, the beam antennas, the gap antennas, and some of the verticals and other antennas, but they tend to cover parts of the band, and they also tend to be antennas that will maybe only cover certain bands. Where the interesting thing about the fan dipole is that you can add as many elements as you want and cover the gambit from, basically from 10 and all, as many segments as you want to add to the fan and cover you all the way down to 160 if you've got enough room to run the wire out that far. Another interesting thing is that if you have availability to a tower, you can suspend the center part of the fan dipole from the tower and still use the same antenna and then actually drag it higher. You can pull it up to 75 feet. And now you've really got a performer. And if you want to swing it down on both sides, you can have it swing down like an inverted V. Let me let it drop for a second. I think there's a breaking station in there. You're recognized. I've just passed back to Dick. But the other thing that's nice about having a fan dipole arrangement off of a tower or some very, very high suspension point in the middle is that now you've got a little bit of vertical polarization, a little bit of horizontal polarization, and you're not just stuck with a dipole pointing in, one direction. It gives you a fairly decent amount of coverage, and altitude with that antenna certainly is really king. Let me pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Glenn. And, a tower gives you all kinds of capability. From my point of view and from Mel's point of view, real hands, if at all possible, move in the direction of a tower eventually. Gives you an awful lot of performance. Edwin, as long as you're asking us and giving us a comment on this subject, go right ahead. And if otherwise, if you've got a new subject, I'll add you to the list and we'll get to you after one other person ahead of you. K2GJE, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick, I just wanted to talk to you about the reception out here tonight. Also in reference to the Connecticut net, over.
Very fine, Edwin. That was mentioned earlier. There's a tremendous band opening going tonight where the Torrington repeater on this frequency, where we share that frequency, is coming through and bombing the daylights out of us. Also, the Eastern repeater is under a state of repair, the 147.375. And so I know what you're going through. We know it's tough. Mother Nature is doing it to us. And looks like we got to suffer. I wonder if there's anything you want to add to that, Edwin. K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, okay. I now know that the Eastern Link is down, and I didn't know if you wanted to know the call letters of the repeater up there in Connecticut. I've been listening to you and some of the other stations on the input frequency on 250. And you're as clear as a bell. But on the 850, it's breaking up out here. What is clear as a bell on 250 is breaking up out here like there's too much audio coming into the repeater, over.
I hear you. When you're getting the kind of overload you're getting, you hear effects like that. Also, we are getting some other crazy effects going on at the repeater tonight, again, due to the band opening. Every so often, blasts of audio come through that sounds like an intermodulation distortion at the repeater site, and what's going on could very well be more complicated than that. Okay, we've got Gary and also Mel. I know we're getting beyond our normal 9 o'clock period in which we go over to your mailbag to make sure that we catch the other people who communicate with you and they don't have their ham license yet, and they've got a curfew for going to bed. So let me pass it over to Mel to make a decision as to whether or not we should go to the mailbag first or try to pick up Gary at this time. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Well, let's put it this way. It is getting late, and 20 minutes to 10, and I know we're going to lose part of the audience. And so I scanned through. I'll let go anything that's really involved with it. A little too late. However, I've got two questions from a group of young hams again that's apropos to what we've been discussing, Dick, over.
Go right ahead with those, Mel. And you sound good at the high power.
Try to make a note for myself here. The question is, basically, because we've had quite a number of discussions on magnetism and perpetual motion, and a couple of young hams said they'd like a little bit more information. What is perpetual motion? Because one of them says that they have a clock in its house that's been sitting on the mantelpiece, and supposedly is a perpetual motion clock. Is that a perpetual motion piece for equipment, or is that some kind of a special piece, that clock that you don't really have to wind? I don't know what keeps it going, but I have heard of those clocks, the perpetual clock. But really, what constitutes perpetual motion, over?
John, good question. It has a little bit of a problem of definition, particularly with reference to that clock, and I'll get there in a minute. Classically, though, there is a very difficult to counter law of physics, and I think if you could call it a law, more than just a concept, that says that there is conservation of energy. That if I'm undergoing some kind of a process where I put energy into the process, something takes place, like a light or rotary motion or heat or whatever is supposed to take place in the process. And if I carefully measure the total amount of energy going in and the total amount of energy coming back out, they equal each other once you account for all the losses. And throughout history, there have been a number of people who had weights that flipped down in funny ways on wheels, which look like they're going to continuously turn the wheel all by itself and give you some extra power output with nothing but gravity going in. And there's been tremendous numbers of things where people have made the claim, let me drop, that you can either prove, you can either provide energy from nothing, or you can provide a small amount of energy and get a lot more out of it. And whether or not that is true and can really be done, some of those are left to be investigated. So are you violating conservation of energy is one of the first things to investigate. Are you violating the second law of thermodynamics and so on? But in the case of the so-called perpetual motion clock, and there used to be one sitting in the jewelry store in Farmingdale, it was Smith Jewelry way back in the late 40s. It was called the automaton clock. The clock had a great big wheel at the bottom that rotated very slowly, and the clock had no source of energy, no batteries, nothing connected to it, and it ran continuously and kept very accurate time. At the time, I think the thing was a $1,200 clock. In 1948, that's equivalent to $50,000 today, an extremely expensive clock. What was it really doing? It was a barometer. As Mother Nature's air pressure goes up and down, instead of moving the needle on a barometer as your bellows are being pushed in and out, this thing was winding a spring. So the variations in air pressure were winding the clock, and you were getting free energy. Is that perpetual motion? You could call it that for advertising purposes. Let me drop. But that particular clock that I'm talking about now, that was in Smith Jewelry Store, had a definable source of energy. I mean, I could be taking the sun that shines into my backyard, aim it at some thermal panels that heat the water that I'm using, and I could say I'm getting the energy free of charge, or it could be going into photovoltaics, and I'm getting voltage out of it, and I could run various things in my house. I could call it perpetual motion. All I've really done is taking the solar energy that's been available for my lifetime, and I've converted some of it into thermal energy, electric energy, or whatever. And I'm getting it for free, per se, not counting the investment of the hardware. And I could call that perpetual motion. So, as you can tell, we've got a bit of a problem of definition here. But the classic definition of perpetual motion is something that really has no apparent, easily quantifiable source of energy, and I'm getting something out of it, or I'm getting more out than I put in. And so various people have been looking for the exceptions to the rules. I wouldn't say it's an open and shut case, but let me say that the true perpetual motion, by the conventional definition, is at least extremely difficult, if not impossible. So go slow on jumping on that particular bandwagon and investing a whole lot of money would be the recommendation of some conservative individuals. I know that's only a partial answer. This is really a kind of a complicated subject. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, whether it be barometer or the sun or a magnet operating, there has to be something that I'm sure is going to act upon whatever device we're going to use. If there is, can be done in some way or another. We're going to be harnessing some kind of a mechanical contrivance that's got to have something, you know, to act upon. So if you say the sun, yeah, well, that's a source of energy, no doubt. And but you're saying that, in other words, pure perpetual motion means nothing acting on it, that's something just going to be sitting there and running without magnetic forces or barometric forces or wind forces or anything. It's something, a machine that's got to be sitting there just independent by itself with nothing working on it from the outside, and that's what's got to constitute perpetual motion, correct? Over.
I have a comment.
Let's say that that's one possible definition of the classical kinds of perpetual motion that people have said things against in the past. There's other kinds of perpetual motion. I mean, there's all kinds of energy available to us. Wind, solar, tide, geothermal, photovoltaic, and I guarantee there's a whole lot more. Barometric pressure variation. The sun is providing 1,300 watts per square meter of solar radiation on the surface of the Earth for the last 5 billion years. We have reason to believe the sun's going to continue doing it for another 5 billion years. When it comes to really going to the horse's mouth, to really going to the beginning of the Nile, the source of real energy that mankind has the possibility of using, 99.99% of it is solar, and a little bit of it is nuclear, and left over from the way the Earth was created. But anything you do that uses solar, but be careful now on what you define as solar. I'll pick up with Leslie in a minute. 10 by 2nd.
WS2N.
Paul also recognized the sun creates hot spots on the Earth. The hot spots create thermal, what a sailplane pilot calls a thermal pile of wind, sort of, in other words, rising air somewhere, which makes the wind flow. Sun is shining on the ocean and heating up certain portions of it. It makes the North American gyre in the Gulf Stream. So the sun is doing all kinds of things and making all kinds of sources of energy that we can tap into. And I could, as an advertising claim, say I put this great big turbine below the ocean level 500 miles out from the tip of Florida. I'm in the middle of the Gulf Stream, and I'm getting megawatts of power out of it, and I could call it perpetual motion if I want to, as an advertising claim. Well, a good scientist nowadays can recognize how the sun is heating the water, how the water is warm in some spots and cold in others, how the Gulf Stream created. And so there's known sources of moving mass in that ocean, and I'm tapping into that. And you could say I'm getting free energy if I just conveniently forget about the great big resources in hardware that I've created and have to start tapping into that. But renewable energy resources nowadays is a very desirable field to get into, because we're suddenly realizing that the petroleum products that are available to us, although they're extremely desirable, they're kind of finite, they're expensive, and they're coming from portions of the world that contain people that don't like us. To be dependent on pure petroleum for a major source of our energy is a less than desirable situation. Anything you can do to get around that, some of the research Wesley is doing, he's going to hopefully find us a way to get around some of that. Wesley wanted to make a comment. I'll keep it a little bit brief, even though I didn't. In 2XJN, K2RIW, the TechNet. I'll wait a couple of seconds beyond the beep, Wesley.
Boy. Okay, this is N2XJN. Well, a lot of people know that I'm trying to investigate or investigate the possible sources of free energy, and I concentrate myself on the Tesla project. Here's the situation. I stopped using the wording perpetual motion. And the reason for that is that I strongly believe that the law of conservation energy applies with a certain variation to that law to everything. Here's the point. Over-unity or unity is probably the best way to describe that. So let's say somebody purchased houses and he's got, let's say, 40% of money after all of the expenses being paid. So now, in his budget, he's got over-unity. Because he is not only capable of paying that, but he has money left over. But guess what? This money comes from the tenant. Let me just... So, somebody somewhere along the way has to pay for this over-unity. At the same token, I may say that if we have a grant, nobody said that the electrons flow from the device to the grant. Maybe this is the reverse way. And my understanding is that whatever is your over-unity, that energy comes from somewhere. The only thing is that not necessarily we realize what this energy is coming from. In the 90s, I was doing a project for NASA, and that was from geophysics, and it was rapid resonance acoustical profiling. We've got a patent for it. And it was actually a very simple device, which was the piezoelectric foil that was put on the ground and was sensing natural vibration of the ground. And somebody may ask, okay, what is that signal that is coming from that is then connected to that piezoelectric foil, and then the analog to digital converter is being used, and then we have the voltage there. But it comes from the vibration. Do we have to pay for this vibration? Like a tenant pay for to the landlord? No, we don't. But there is a simple understanding that everything that doesn't cost you the money but lasts the typical lifetime of the human being is the unity or over-unity, whichever way we name it. And that's my simple explanation to that phenomena. Back to you, Dick.
W2YY.
Crazy. Yeah, Joe recognized, but Paul first had a question or comment. WS2N, go ahead, Paul. Yeah, maybe Paul's been jammed by the Torrington repeater and can't hear us. Joe?
Be mad then.
Say again?
Were you coming back to me now?
Yes, I was. Go right ahead, Paul.
I think the band opening is starting to clear up. I was just moving my antenna around, coming back to where you could hear me. I was so far off that, you know, I could hear them, but I don't, you know, by facing that far south, I don't know if I was going to be able to make it into a repeater, transmitting wise. But yeah, I wanted to make a comment about the perpetual motion. From what I see, the closest thing to it. And it's really not true, but the closest thing to it would be the Pioneer and the Voyager spacecraft. I mean, we've launched them off into space, and they're going to go on for not only hundreds of thousands of years, but billions of years, and they're just going to randomly travel around the galaxy. the galaxy makes a turn, I think it's every 250 million years, and it'll just gradually go around and around. But even that is not perpetual motion, because it will be going from star system to star system over those billions of years. So even that's not perpetual motion, Dick. And as far as the power is being produced by the plutonium on board, and that's heating up this carbonized material like blankets surrounding it, and that actually gets hot, and then they have many thermocouples attached, and they're actually in parallel and series, depending, you know, how many it is they're using and putting out their voltages that way. So eventually that will quit. They say the plutonium will go on for probably, you know, maybe hundreds of years, but the reason they're going to have a failure is the thermocouples, the metal, you know, the thermocouple is the dissimilar metals touching one another. Eventually there'll be failures at those points, and that's what's really going to make the spacecraft maybe die around 2025. But they'll go on forever, and that's not perpetual motion either, I don't think. I mean, you know, you have gravity from all the different star systems. Back to you.
Yeah, the Voyager spacecraft, the two of them now, close to 10 billion miles away from us. Three times, approximately, the distance to Pluto. We made a great big investment to launch them in the first place. But the majority of the kinetic energy, the energy of motion, the velocity of those Voyager spacecraft, a big portion of the energy came from gravity assist maneuvers. A spacecraft did a flyby of Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus, I think, in one case. And in the pace of carefully flying by those planets, they picked up excess energy from those planets, which flung them further and farther out, because we don't have the resources at the time of launching of them to send them at anywhere near that distance. And yes, the nuclear power supply on board is going to go on for a large number of years, and you don't have to supply extra energy to it, and it looks like it's free. It's not. You've made a great big investment to create that nuclear power source, and the reason for doing that, let me drop, was the fact that the sun out there at the distance they're at probably looks like one of the dim stars that you see in the sky at night right now. Take one of those dim stars that you see at night. When you're out at the distance where Voyager is, that's what our sun looks like. Obviously, setting up a set of solar cells out there, solar panels, would give you milliwatts of power when you need kilowatts of power, so it would be less than flea power, if you know what I mean. So they had to put a nuclear power supply on board. Fascinating subject. There was one other person who wanted to make a comment. Joe, I think, wants to make a comment. W2RYY, go ahead with your comment, Joe. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Hey, she's crazy.
Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, one more call. Are you there? KC2AZ, as long as you're making a comment on this subject, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir. My name is Dick.
Dick, it's Bob. It's AC2AZ. Yeah, just one quick comment. All this philosophy talk is nice about perpetual motion, but there's really only one correct answer, and that is there is no such thing unless you intend to violate our laws of physics. And all this other stuff, discussion about free energy, that's a whole different topic. But the answer to those little fellows at Mel's end is that there is no such thing as perpetual motion. A lot of claims, but no such thing.
Comment.
Now, hold on, Wesley. Bob, there's reasonably strong evidence that what you're saying is probably true. And so some of the things that are called perpetual motion shouldn't have been. And by the conventional definition, there appears to be none. And so occasionally somebody will mislabel something as perpetual motion, thinking they're going to gain some extra publicity because of it. That's a bit of a mistake. When it comes to organizations like the U.S. Patent and Trademark Organization, if you use the word perpetual motion in a application for patent, guarantee you'd get a whole lot of flack. Okay, let me go over to Gary, because we've been keeping him waiting a little bit too long. W2MIT. Gary, go right ahead with your question, because I think you're the last person on the list before John. W2MIT, K2RIW in the tech net.
You're going to add K2 again.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Dick. A very interesting net tonight, and I had no idea that the wait would be this long to put a question in. By the way, don't fret about the 60 minutes. It was a rerun tonight, and you can always catch those episodes online, and you can even get an email telling you what they're going to be in advance. But my question is not ham radio per se, but it's related. It's a question about 60-cycle hum, believe it or not. The application is a very high-end Polycom conference phone that connects to an analog telephone line. Very high-end, meaning it's got some sophisticated electronics in it with, you know what they look like, right? It's a tripod. Sometimes they call it a spider. And it ensures that one mic is on at a time, and it's very sensitive and so on. But the thing is, it's got some noise reduction features. It's got some automatic gain control. And when it's hooked up to the phone line, there is a very slight but annoying 60-cycle hum that's audible. So here's the two questions. Let me let it drop. The two questions are, one, I'm having a debate with my friend about whether that 60-cycle hum that we're hearing can be termed radio interference, whether or not it's radio interference, and, you know, 60 cycles itself is, I don't think, a wave that's going to radiate through the air, but that's question number one. Question number two is if you have any practical advice for solving such a problem.
Yeah, one of your virtual questions is, where does radio begin? Most people will think one megacycle of energy put into something that can transmit that energy, something that functions like an antenna. Very few people will doubt that that's radio. Can 60 cycle be radio? Well, it is an electromagnetic wave that you're experiencing. And it's sort of academic what we call it. However, you're experiencing the classic case of the undesirable function of Faraday's law and Lenz's law. Somewhere in your environment there's a transformer, most likely, but not necessarily, creating a magnetic field. Somewhere in your environment there's something equivalent to a coil of wire, although it may not look like it, which is intercepting that changing magnetic field. Therefore, an undesired voltage is being coupled into that wire. That's Faraday's law. Whenever there is a loop of wire, or what can be studied as a loop of wire, even though it may not look like a loop, but there's a closed form path of conducting material, and in the area that's being encompassed by the closed path, if there is any source of magnetic field, and if that magnetic field is changing in any way, in polarity, in magnitude, or whatever, you will induce a voltage in that conducting wire path. It may be microvolts, it may be millivolts, it may be volts, depending on the sensitivity of your electronics connected to that wire. It's above threshold or it's not above threshold. So one of the main things you want to know is how to eliminate it. Let me drop. And that's very similar to what you would do to eliminate electromagnetic interference of a radio nature. You create some kind of a sniffer. In the case of radio, I would put some kind of a sensitive receiver with some kind of an antenna in front and start walking around the environment and find out where is that particular frequency coming from by finding out as I wave it left and right, up and down, rotate it in polarization. I try to find the place where I get the strongest effect into my sniffer, and then almost automatically you'll find a transformer that's not properly designed, that has a leaking magnetic field, and either you can reorient it or move it somewhere else or change the nature of that power supply that uses that transformer. That's a for instance. That's if it's a magnetic field and I think it's a high probability it is. But it's not the only kind. Ordinary 60 cycle power, if I took the wiring of the socket of my house and I ran a wire close to a sensitive piece